Hello, this is the Angry GM, and this is Q and Angry. This particular Q and Angry is a follow-up to two articles that I have written recently, two bullshit articles, entitled Stop Trying to Make Open World Games and You Don't Need to Run an Open World Game, a massive two-parter in which I finally explain why you should not try to translate your Elden Rings and your Breath of the Wilds into a tabletop role-playing game campaign, or run one of those wide-open sandbox, open-world, do-whatever-the-hell-you-want, exploration-focused tabletop role-playing games with no story or goals or anything else. I already wrote 10,000 words about that, and presumably any of you listening to this already read those 10,000 words, because this is a follow-up podcast and it would be kind of stupid to listen to it without the thing it's following up. So without any further ado, there is just one point I want to clarify from the article before I take on the few questions that I have, but it is a bit of a doozy. I noticed in the comment section and in the Discord chat for my supporters, thank you everybody who supports my work financially and gets access to the Discord and also gets access to the thread where you get to ask these questions for the next Q and Angry follow-up episode. I noticed in the discussion that followed these articles that lots of people started using the phrase "the illusion of choice." Okay, this was a response to me talking about how there is no Santa Claus, agency is pretend, and all of that stuff. And people started saying, oh, okay, yeah, no, obviously, it's the illusion of choice. Players don't have the choice, quantum ogres and all of that shit. Okay, I might have gone a little too hard on this whole there is no such thing as Santa Claus thing, because that is actually not the point. And I had to correct more than a few people, and especially one person in the comment section in particular, who kept insisting on using the phrase illusion of supposed player choice or something like that. And you can tell from that wording that it's just a loaded connotation. I had to correct it, because if that's how you're thinking of this, if you're thinking about this as the illusion of choice, as you are pretending to give players choices when really you are tricking them into doing exactly what you intend to do, you have understood nothing I'm talking about, and that is not really how this works at all. Of course, I didn't expect you to understand all of it at this point, because the whole true scenario designery course is predicated on the idea, it's predicated on several ideas, but one of the several ideas on which the true scenario designery course is predicated is that player agency is trickier than you think it is, but it is not really just about giving the players the freedom to choose. To be 100% clear here, players have choice. Those choices are real. When the players choose what to do at the game table, it is real, and you as a role-playing game master must actually give your players choices, and you must respond to the choices they make. Likewise, as a scenario designer, when you're writing adventures for players to play, whether you are then going to run those adventures for players later or just publish them for other people to run, you must give the players choices. And those choices are real choices. This is not the illusion of choice. It's not imaginary. Players really do get to make choices. That's part and parcel of the whole role-playing game gig. Okay? However, the key to being a true scenario designer and also understanding half the shit I said in this whole stop trying to make open world games, but don't worry, you don't need to thing, is you cannot offer a human being a choice without impacting the choice they make. That's very important to understand. It is impossible to give a human being a choice without somehow biasing them. There is a whole field of study on this. It's currently going under the name choice architecture. And if you want to learn more about choice architecture, I would recommend picking up a book entitled The Elements of Choice by Eric J. Johnson, which goes through some of the basics of choice architecture and the psychology behind it. The point is, understanding how you frame the choices you present to people affects their decision-making process, okay? As a scenario designer or a game master, you must understand that the way you present choices, the way you frame them, affects the choices the players will make. And you must use your power for good because you have a goal. Now, the fact that you have this power, the whole, this goes for everyone. Anybody who gives anybody a choice has the power to influence their choices, okay? You have to know what your goal is and thus use that power carefully. So, for example, if you were doing a scientific survey, or if you were gathering votes in a free and open election, hypothetically, I'm not talking about any real elections that might be happening in the real world, in the recent past, or in the near future, just the hypothetical concept of free and open election, you would want to present options in such a way as to minimize the bias, to allow people to make the most objective choice possible. You would want to pull yourself out of the process of decision-making as much as possible. However, your goal as a scenario designer is not to make some sort of objective scientific analysis or gather people's free opinions. It is instead to provide them a subjectively fun gameplay experience, which means instead of withdrawing from the choice and saying, I'm just going to make this as objective as possible and be out of the way as much as possible, even though it's impossible to be completely out of the way, you try to be as much out of the way as possible. Instead, you realize, I'm trying to make this great gameplay experience. So what I should be doing with my power to influence choice is influencing people toward choices that will lead them to the most fun gameplay experiences, the most satisfying gameplay experiences. That is the principle of scenario design, and also why this whole open world thing became a thing, by which I mean my speech. Okay, the truth of the matter is, if you were to drop players into a giant, vast world sprinkled with fun things to do, and then say, go to town, kids, it turns out that actually wouldn't be the most fun experience. You don't want the players wandering around looking for the fun, because then it's a crapshoot whether or not they find the fun and how long it takes. Instead, what you'd like to do is to have them make a choice, and then that choice lead them to something fun. And so video game designers who run open, who design open world games, don't just drop you in the middle of a map and fill it with stuff to do and hope you trip over it. They instead manipulate your choices and present the world in such a way that you will find fun things to do and stumble on a good gameplay experience. It is very subtle. It takes a lot of skill and talent to do it right. And that's what they're doing. And if you don't know how to do that, and especially how to do that at a narrative tabletop role-playing game table instead of in a visual video game world, if you try to emulate what you think they're doing, you're going to screw it up and you're going to end up with players who aren't having as much fun as they could have. And this is the other thing to keep in mind, by the way, this whole aren't having as much fun as they could have is an important phrasing, because I always hear from people who are like, well, I've been running hex crawls for years and my players have a perfectly good time. And I'm like, well, have you tried running one of my better hex crawls that aren't really hex crawls? Maybe they'd have an even better time. Hmm? Because the goal should be to give them the best possible time. But anyway, that aside, the point is that the choices are real. This isn't the illusion of choice. We're not tricking players into thinking they can't make choices. Instead, we are recognizing our role in influencing the player's choices and using that to make the best games possible and also just to make games playable. Because to some extent, games are very difficult to play if they do not bias your choices in certain ways. Like if they don't, like if you're just in a room and you have to run away from the monster, like take the asylum demon at the beginning of Dark Souls, where you get dropped in the room and then there's a monster. You're supposed to run away from the monster before you get killed. And if you spent the whole time standing there trying to pick out the escape route, even though you recognized you were supposed to run away, and now you're standing like, where's this guy? I go, I don't know. Which way do I go? Which way do I go? And like scrambling around trying to find it, you get smashed before you get the fun of escaping. That ain't a great experience. So the game instead uses ways to pull you toward that particular direction so that you know it's there just to make the game playable. That is your responsibility as a scenario designer and a game designer. You have the power to influence people's choices in the way you present them, and you must use that power responsibly because with great power comes great yada yada yada. And now, with that whole speech clarified, and I will add, this is not going to be the last time I talk about this. This is not going to be my last word on the subject. In fact, the whole True Scenario Design course, which these articles were technically not a part of, but are nonetheless a part of it, the whole True Scenario Designery, True Scenario Designery course is all about this shit. It's all about using the power of game design for good instead of evil or stupidity. So with that in mind, let me start addressing the questions that the people have left me. And the first question that was left for me comes from Diego, who wanted me to list some psychological tricks to funnel players in the proper direction. And I find that question offensive because this is not a game, a magic show, and we are not doing parlor tricks here. This isn't about, you know, just like, ooh, abracadabra, I used magician's force to make you pick the right card. That's bullshit, you know, like mere adventure game design crap. And I will not be doing any of that. Could I? Yes. I've talked all about all these tricks throughout the years. Like how if you're using a map and you're drawing a dungeon for the players, or you're revealing it with Fog of War on a virtual tabletop, and there are three closed doors leading out of a room and one open hallway, then most players will tend, because of the heuristic of completeness, to want to go down the open hallway before they'll start opening doors. And if there is anything that looks like a path, even if it has nothing to do with the player's goals, players will subconsciously assume it leads to the goal. So if they come to an intersection and down one way there is just a path and the other way a narrow stream is running further into the dungeon, the players will assume the stream leads to the goal, even if the goal has nothing to do with streams and water. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to follow those paths, because you also have to understand what mode they're in. Are they in goal-oriented mode, goal-seeking mode, or are they in exploration mode, which you could also think of as reactance mode? So, for example, if the players are goal-minded and there is something that looks like a path, even if there's no reason to believe it will bring you to the goal at all, the goal-minded players will proceed toward it, but the exploration-minded players will ignore that path and check every other path. And likewise, the players who see the open doorway, they may actually open all three doors first, because again, because of completeness, they're assuming that that path is going to lead them toward their goal, and so they're going to check all the other doors before they advance the plot. So you kind of have to understand how people make decisions, and you see already how I can't just give you tricks, because the tricks by themselves don't work. Tricks are complex things. If you want the players in exploration mode or goal-seeking mode, you have to have set that up, which is why we go back to the subject of choice architecture and understanding how getting people to, or influencing people's choices are about, I mean, there's six pillars currently in the study of choice architecture. They defaults, framing, anchoring, feedback, expectations, and salience. And so if you understand how those things work, you understand how to frame a choice. It's not a matter of doing a parlor trick. It's not a matter of saying pick a card and really the cards are marked on the back. It's not a magician's trick. It's instead understanding how those principles work and also how people make decisions, which is people make decisions based on two things, which is cognitive biases and heuristics. Cognitive biases are tendencies to make certain decisions without really thinking about them. Cognitive biases are ways of filtering out information from the world. And heuristics are ways people make decisions quickly without having to put a whole lot of thought and time into it. So you have to understand all this shit to really know how to manipulate people. And a lot of this will be worked into true scenario design because you got to understand it. But no, I can't just give you a bunch of parlor tricks and I'd be doing you a disservice. And half the time they wouldn't work because it is more complicated than that. Plus, if I could do that, I wouldn't have to write a whole series on true scenario design. Diego then went on to ask why the Angry's open world game series started with curated character design and whether that was to temper expectations, to avoid player reactance, or whatever. So I went back and looked at the whole Angry's open world game series, which I published several years ago now and referenced in these articles, which was an instruction series on how to run a quote unquote open world game. Though, as I explained in the articles, what I was really doing was showing you a bunch of tricks to fake running an open world game while actually just building a game one step in front of the players the whole time. So I went back and I looked through the whole series and I actually cannot find where I said it starts with curated character generation. Also, I love that I've now just started, I've built such a lexicon of abbreviations and shit that people just speak to me in gibberish abbreviations. Like Diego was like, why did AOWG start with CCG? Yeah, CCG, blah, blah, blah. Like, I had to think, I'm like, what the hell do those abbreviations even mean? Okay, but anyway, curated character generation, by the way, is just my term for the GM deciding what options are available as a subset of all the options that come pouring out of the fire hose of any game system that has been out for more than 2 years. Okay, that's all it is. It's nothing fancy. And the thing is that I recommend that absolutely all the time. Okay, as a game master, you should never ever say to your players, you may generate characters from the entire body of options that exist in this entire game system if there are options that exist in more than one book. If your game is limited to just one core rule book, you can say, okay, you can have all the options there, but even then, I suggest that you don't. I suggest that you actually pare down the list into a more manageable number, depending, of course, on how many options there are. I never said Angry's open world game should start with curated character generation, and thus the premise that I did that a purpose to train people out of their reactance, that's false. But I also want to warn people not to do this thing where you become obsessed with one buzzword and assume it's the reason for all the things. I taught you now about psychological reactance, which is the tendency of people to rebel against rules and limitations that seem to threaten their freedom. And now that you have seen that, you now look at everything in terms of psychological reactants. But the thing is, sometimes reactants is a thing that is going to happen. The point is not to ever have it, or wait, the point is not to not ever trigger psychological reactants. At some level, that's impossible. You're going to trigger it. The point is, as a game master, to know this is one of the cognitive biases that people operate under. This is one of the ways they filter their perception of the world and the way it shapes their behavior. Is that if you have someone who thinks they are free and then you take an option away, they get angry and they tend to fight back. They get rebellious. As a game master, you neither need to avoid it or lean into it or anything else. You need to know it exists. And how you deal with it in different situations is based on what you're trying to accomplish. For example, I talked about in Elden Ring how they purposely used people's psychological reactants to give them a path they knew they would ignore, to bounce them off the path, right? So that's a way of knowing that reactants is an issue and then using that as a tool in your arsenal, okay? Knowing that psychological reactants is an issue, then suggests something about the choice architecture of character generation. And that is, well, I know people tend to rebel when they feel like things are being taken from them. So if I am going to do curated character generation, I should think very carefully about how I'm framing that choice so as to mitigate the possibility of psychological reactants. And as a game master, I should also expect that I'm going to encounter a certain amount of reactants and just be ready to say, sorry, kids, it's my way or the highway. That's the point. The point is not to like train people or mitigate this or deal with it. It's just to know this is one of the 10,000 things that frames how people make decisions. There are 10,000 things that influence how people make decisions, by the way. You, as a game designer or scenario designer, whatever you want to be, need to know about every last one of them so that you can frame decisions in the best way possible. That's the point. Finally, this is going to be the last question for the day because I'm just looking at the clock. French Rice Merman asks if I've ever run any games based on video games and if it can be done well. Because apparently French Rice Merman took from my 10,000 words of careful analysis of the difference between open world games as they're presented in video games and open world games as they're presented at the role-playing gaming table, as me saying you can never base any role-playing game on any video game ever, that's my point. Which is a ridiculous point because I have been talking for years about all of the things you can actually learn from video games. Have I based campaigns on video games? Of course I have, all the time. I do it a lot. My current campaign, my current AD&D 2E campaign, Chain of Stars, is actually based on The Legend of Zelda Link to the Past. How is it based on that? It's based on it structurally. Okay, the act structure of Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, it inspired the act structure of my campaign as I planned it out. Okay, it's an accordion act structure where you have a linear first act, then a somewhat open second act, and then a linear third act, and then a somewhat open fourth act, and then you end with a fifth act. But I think I took out two steps on that. So it's an accordion, but I took out some of the folds. But anyway, that's one way that you can base things on a video game. Another way is to base things on a setting or a plot. You know, I ran a campaign based on Skyrim because, you know, I got obsessed with Skyrim back in the day, and I absolutely loved the the Northern European Nordic setting. I loved that setting and all of the different biomes in Skyrim province, and so I decided to do that. The key is to understand what does and does not translate from a video game to a role-playing game, and to adjust what you're trying to do to the medium you're trying to do it in. As I did note, you can actually run an exploration-based, go ahead and decide whatever you want, ignore the main plot, do whatever you want in the game world kind of campaign, if you know how to do it right, but you don't do it the way the video games do it. Because the way the video games do it works for video games, but absolutely does not work at the tabletop, and it invites problems that would be crippling at tabletop role-playing games. That's the key. Understand the differences in the media so that you can take inspiration from one thing and say, boil it down, like distill down the inspiration into the essence of what you're trying to capture, then say, how can I make that work in this other medium, given the specifics and the constraints and the strengths and the weaknesses of the medium? That's how you do it right. And building a giant ass map and sprinkling it with stuff and saying, I'm running Breath of the Wild in D&D is not the way to do that. And that was my point.